So, like I say, the Constitution was in effect until 1843. Full liberty and religious concerns. This is actually quote from the Charter. Full liberty in religious concernments and that true piety, rightly grounded upon gospel principles, will give the best and greatest security to sovereignty. And what they mean by that was a Christian population dedicated to true values of Christ are the greatest guarantee that a colony will succeed. Now, that language was written specifically to tell South Carolina to take a flying leap. And when we get to South Carolina, we'll talk about that. And will lay in the hearts of men the strongest obligations to true loyalty. In other words, a colony that is founded on Christian principles, that promotes the gospel in an active way, will have members that are faithful, that are profitable, and will secure the long-term success of the colony. That's right there in the Charter. And again, that language was there until 1843. The current Constitution of Rhode Island, which was just written in 1919, has a fairly similar claim. And yes, it has been taken. The federal Supreme Court has said the state constitutions are not actionable under the Bill of Rights. That's the very separate thing. So, just that statement there. Full liberty in religious concernments, rightly grounded, and true piety grounded upon the gospel principles. We have the best and greatest security to the state. And these are the kinds of statements that you... This statement, or something similar to this, is found in all of the 13 colonial charters. All right, next slide. Massachusetts. Everybody's familiar. Massachusetts is the one we're most familiar with. You know the Plymouth Colony, the Mayflower Compact, which is the first true constitution in the United States. And it says that good government is founded on gospel principles, and we bind ourselves in Christian liberty, et cetera, et cetera. Now, Massachusetts, the Massachusetts colonies are founded in 1620 as Plymouth Colony and then the Massachusetts Bay Colony in 1630. Connecticut shortly thereafter. The Connecticut colony had been in existence in 1603. It applies for a royal charter in 1635. And the Connecticut colony's charter is just incredible. Almost any place you cut into it, you get language like this. Our said people, inhabitants there, may be so religiously, peacefully, and civilly governed that their good life and orderly conversation may win and invite the natives of the country to the knowledge and obedience of the only true God and his Savior of mankind and the Christian faith, which in our royal intentions and the adventures of free possession is the only and principal end of this plantation. Notice the order. They may be religiously, peacefully, and civilly governed, that their good life and orderly conversation may invite the natives to the knowledge of God, his Savior, and Christian faith, in that order. And you notice that it doesn't say anything about serving king and crown. And so the Delaware colony then, or I'm sorry, the Connecticut colony, established to be an evangelical outpost as a way to reach out to the Indians and North Carolina. Again, we'll talk about it a bit. Thomas Hooker is founding the Connecticut, founder of Connecticut. He is a Puritan minister. Now, remember, the Plymouth colony is leaving because of religious persecution. Hooker is under the same persecution. In fact, he was working with the Plymouth colonists, but was in jail. When he got free, he was able to get a charter from the Crown, raised an enormous amount of money. In fact, the Connecticut colony was better funded than the Plymouth colony, largely because Hooker had richer friends and apparently had a talent for fundraising. Got himself 180 people to come over, and so by 1635, Connecticut is up and running under this. And they took their obligation to evangelize the Indians quite seriously. He brought over quite a few Quakers, quite a few Puritans, and he trained them to be, I guess today we call them circuit riders. There were 10 native tribes there, and these people went around and went around. And they really tried hard to be faithful to the gospel. And my favorite story about Connecticut, it's kind of a tough story, but five of these circuit riders were killed by the Indians in the first 4 years. The others just kept going and kept going. And Connecticut is one of the few that did not have the type of Indian conflicts early on that you see going on in Massachusetts and Pennsylvania and Virginia and North Carolina. Connecticut colonists, because they were Puritans and a large number were Quakers, they were pacifists. And the Indians took advantage of that at first, and eventually the Indians began to realize, well, let's make trade. And then, of course, the colonial policy towards the native population became more centralized and things turned bad. But Connecticut, like Pennsylvania, made a real effort to reach the Indians and understand their culture and their ideas and bring the gospel. A number of just amazing ministers are associated with the Connecticut colony. Next slide. Virginia is originally established for economic development, open markets, trades with the native population. The Roanoke colony fails. Jamestown succeeds. Jamestown is established in 1607. Starts slowly. Now, Jamestown and Plymouth are what we call parallel colonies. They don't really get their pickup until 1620. Jamestown has a much harder start because Jamestown was seen as a wealth extraction colony. So as a result, you get a lot of young men going in, trying to make their fortune and go back home. They don't have families with them. Plymouth, on the other hand, is to be a long-term colony. Families come over. Jamestown quickly goes into tobacco, cotton, and rice, which means very quickly in the slave trade. And so Jamestown grows very slowly. The Plymouth colony is established by Puritans for religious development first, economic development second. And the difference is the Plymouth colonists were more committed to the gospel and had what we call that Protestant work ethic. They worked hard and were much more successful. The Jamestown colony took really forever to get going, and they didn't have their big growth until 1758 when the Anglican Church sent a large number of church fathers in to try to re-Christianize the colony. Next slide. Virginia eventually did grow a religious heritage. By the time we get to Thomas Jefferson, it has a very strong religious heritage. Jefferson wrote that government imposing religion begets habits of hypocrisy and meanness, which are a departure from, and the reason I took this quote, this is Jefferson, begets hypocrisy and meanness, which are a departure from the plan of the holy author of our religion. So when people tell you that Jefferson was a deist, you say, eh, not so much. Jefferson is what we call a non-institutional Christian. He didn't like formal religion. He didn't like religious. He hated the Church of England. Wasn't crazy about the Quakers, but that was largely because he thought Quakers were just weird. Didn't have much use for Congregationalists. We call them Presbyterians now. But he was a student of religion. He read the Bible thoroughly. People forget that Jefferson read Greek and Aramaic. Not so good on the Hebrew, but Greek and Aramaic. He'd studied the ancient text. He read the Bible. He read the Quran. He read the Bhagavad Gita. He read all of those texts. And shortly after he left the office of the presidency, he said, having studied all of these, I find that the only religion whose principles truly reflect human nature are those principles found in the gospel. When asked specifically if he was a deist, Jefferson said, I am a Christian in the only sense Christ ever intended, fully committed to his principles above all others. Now, what does he mean by that? It's not clear that Jefferson believed in the death, burial, and resurrection. It's not clear about that. What he does mean is that the principles that Christ laid out, do unto others you have them do unto you, the elements of that, and he has 10 elements, were the elements that we ought to live by. Jefferson was also not convinced that everything in the Gospels were actually inspired, and so he was the first one to do a Reader's Digest condensed edition. And some of the stuff he leaves out are pretty. He's not a big believer in miracles. But on the other hand, Jefferson did believe that Christianity was the only true foundation for government, politics, and ethics. That the principles found in the Bible were the only ones that are consistent. He thought the Quran was interesting, and he understood the attraction of the Quran. But he thought the doctrines laid out in the Quran were exceedingly violent. And just led to conflict rather than comity. Oh, by the way, we skipped something in the Plymouth Plantations and the Massachusetts Bay Colony, Pocahontas. You've seen the Disney movie. All I can say about the Disney movie Pocahontas is they get everything about Pocahontas wrong. Everything wrong. She was of the Powhatan tribe. Her original name was Matatuaka. Matawaka. She was the daughter of Powhatan. Yes, the tribe is named, and the tribal leader takes the name of the tribe, so we don't know what his actual name was. Pocahontas was an Indian princess. Actually, we get that part right in the movie. Although princess kind of doesn't characterize her. Basically, she is the daughter of the leader of the first family. And she does save John Rolfe, and she does save John Smith. But what the movie gets wrong is she was 16 when she converted to Christianity. She spent some time in England talking about the tribes and the tribal structure, and then she came back. She got to speak to Parliament, 17 years old, speaking to Parliament, talking about the Indian structure in the United States. She comes back home. Her father and the tribe come back and say, "You've got to come back with us." And she said, "Okay." Part of that means worshiping the way we worship. Now, the movie shows them worshiping trees and whatnot. No, that was not the worship of the tribe there. Frankly, the Powhatan tribe worshiped money. When you get right down to it, they were a fairly secular tribe. When she realized that she could not exercise her Christian faith, she said, "No, I'm going to stay with the colonists because Christianity is true." I mean, she didn't say it's right, it's what I believe. She said, "It is true, and what you are believing is wrong." And so she broke with her family. She marries John Rolfe. And then dies shortly thereafter. And we're not sure whether she died of a disease or was killed during an Indian invasion. We know that both things happened simultaneously. But on her death, as she was dying, she does say that I go to stand in the presence of my Savior. The Disney movie, completely ignores all of that and paints the Christians out to be big, brutish, dumb people. And yet Pocahontas herself said that she never had so much joy and peace in her life as when she came to Christ. So, that is it. And it's frustrating because if the Pocahontas movie had been made in the 1950s or even early 1960s, it would have emphasized that. So Virginia then, Jefferson, and remember, Jefferson writes the Declaration of Religious Freedoms for the Constitution of Virginia. Jefferson founds the University of Virginia, establishes the School of Religion, and requires all students entering the University of Virginia have 3 courses in Bible and Bible doctrine. And this is the guy who said there's a wall of separation between church and state. What he meant in that letter was the Baptists were writing, because remember, as I said, almost all except Rhode Island of the colonies had an established state church. After the Constitution is adopted in 1787, a number of the states still have an official church. There's nothing in the Constitution that says the states can't do that. The First Amendment meant that the federal government couldn't establish a national church. And the Baptists were writing and saying, well, we're in this state, and the Congregationalists are causing some problem. What do we do? And Jefferson says the Constitution erects a wall of separation, meaning that you can't have an established state church. And the Baptists were happy with that, and they never fussed much more about it until the Supreme Court started going nuts. So there you have, Baptists are one fighting it now, but we're also, it's kind of our fault for getting Jefferson to write such a clear statement there. North and South Carolina. Oh, North and South Carolina. They were carved out of Virginia, largely because the Virginia territory was huge. Technically, the Virginia colony was from the bottom of Pennsylvania, New York, all the way down to Florida. Now, they didn't get Florida because Florida and up to Albany, Georgia, those were all controlled in Spanish. But that's the Virginia territory. It's huge, and it goes coast to coast. And it became clear very early on that Virginia governor couldn't handle all of that, and so they split off the Carolinas, and then the Carolinas quickly split North and South Carolina, largely because of geography. Now, these are economic colonies, and very quickly they're in cotton, they're in slave trading, they're in rice, they're in tobacco, very quickly. It is interesting that the Charter of 1669 says that to be in North Carolina, you could not be a professing atheist. You could not move into the colony if you were an atheist. You could not have a government position if you didn't profess Christ. In spite of all of that, the colony quickly becomes a center of dissipation. Now, the charter also says that if non-believers move into the colony, they are to be welcomed, and I'm quoting now, gently persuaded to come to the gospel. Gentle persuasion became far less gentle as the history of the colony evolved. And the idea that you had to profess Christ, profess God to be a colonist, that didn't last long. By 1720, North and South Carolina were the centers of rum exportation to the Indians. As a specific policy, because the Indians simply couldn't handle alcohol, and there was an enormous demand for rum among the southern tribes, and it caused a series of wars and conflicts. And as a consequence of that, James Oglethorpe, the founder of the colony of Georgia, said, "I can show you a better way to do this." Go to the next slide, and that takes us to the Georgia colony. James Oglethorpe. Oglethorpe's purpose in founding Georgia was basically to stick it to North and South Carolina, to say, we will show you how it can be done. It is an economic colony and it's a defensive colony, but Oglethorpe is a believer. The primary purpose was to be a breakwater between the Spanish in the South and South Carolina, a little bit to the North. That was the whole purpose of the Georgia colony, was to be an early warning, the canary in the cage. When the Spanish came up to invade, Georgia would get hit first, they'd send messengers up, and then while they're being wiped out, South Carolina would organize their defenses. That was kind of the purpose. Oglethorpe had a different plan that he didn't tell anybody about, and so in 1733, the Anne lands, 125 colonists disembark in Savannah. They were actually supposed to go farther upriver to modern-day Franklin Springs, which is kind of right just south of Greenville. But he didn't want to be that far up, because if they were that far up, they would be dependent on South Carolina. If they land and stay in Savannah, they got a nice harbor, and they could grow. I read this before, but I'll read it again. This is from Oglethorpe's own writings. "The Society for the Propagation of the Gospel in Foreign Parts have gloriously exerted themselves on this occasion. They have resolved to advance such a sum of money to the trustees of the colony of Georgia as will enable them to provide for 700 poor Salzburgers. This is laying a foundation for the conversion of the heathen. At the same time, they snatch a great number of poor Christians out of the danger of apostasy. It is to be hoped this laudable example will be followed by private persons who may thus at once do much for the glory of God, for the wealth and trade of Great Britain." Now, the increase of our people on this fruitful continent will probably in due time have a good effect on the natives if we do not shamefully neglect their conversion. If we were moderately attentive to our duty on this head, we have no reason to doubt of their success. The Spaniard has at this day as many Christians as he has subjects in America. We may more reasonably hope to make converts and good subjects of the Indians in amity with us by using them well when we grow numerous in their neighborhood than the Spaniards could have been expected to have done by their inexpressible cruelties. So, Oglethorpe says, let's be an example of good Christian comity, good relation with the Indians. That was one of the colonial rules, was that they had to treat the Indians fairly, treat the Indians well. Again, as an example of what not to do for South Carolina. No rum, no slavery, no cotton. Those are the three primary rules for the colony of Georgia. In 1736, Oglethorpe has to go back to England. By the time he gets back to the colony in 1739, he discovers rum, slaves, and cotton. He walks to the city limits of Savannah, wipes the dust off his feet, goes farther south, and establishes a new city. Georgia will eventually fall prey to southern politics and become a center of cotton slavery and all of that. But understand that its founding was not supposed to be that way. And Oglethorpe's sincere belief was that a sincere effort to evangelize the Indians would create peaceful relations rather than the conflict that they were seeing in North and South Carolina. And for 50 years in Georgia history, he was right. Religion in the colonies. The southern colony is largely Anglican. Mostly because they are official chartered colonies. The North were Congregationalists, basically Methodists. Presbyterians and Lutherans. Lots of Lutherans came to the colonies after us good Methodists had chunked everything out. Baptists come a little bit later, Puritans and Pilgrims, of course, in the North. Now, they're different groups. Puritans were Anglicans who wanted to purify the religion, get the hypocrisy out, and then go back home. Pilgrims were making a firm break with the Church of England and wanted to start over. Quakers came to Pennsylvania and southern New York very early. Quakers were an offshoot of the Puritans. They were called Quakers because, not because they were early forms of Pentecostals, but they were a fairly rowdy religious bunch. They raised their hands when they were singing. They had rock and roll type music. Roger Sherman, who was from Pennsylvania, he was a Declaration signer. He was not real crazy about the Quakers. He thought they were too enthusiastic. He thought their religion was exuberant. And so that's how they got the Quakers. A lot of people think the Quakers are an early form Pentecostalism, but that's not really true. They were just more expressive in their religion. Quakers merged well. I don't have up there the African influence on Christianity in the South, but the African influence on Christianity is just monumental. Southern preachers, I want to tell you, you got to get straight with the gospel. That is an adaptation and draw over from African preachers. The African song style tremendously influences Southern music. What we consider a Southern or bluegrass gospel is a reflection of that African heritage. Southern African, which eventually becomes the American Episcopal, American Methodist Episcopal, American Episcopal Zionist, all of these churches have the same biblical focus. And black churches today still have that focus. It's on the Old Testament. It's on the Exodus. That was their focus, was the Exodus, God's redeeming hand, pulling them out of a foreign land and returning them home. Africa then becomes their image of heaven. The United States is their image of suffering and slavery and servitude in Egypt. You can see the natural parallels there. And there are various strains of African religion that are very mystic and spiritualist in nature. There is a connection between African slave religion and early Pentecostalism. It's not well connected, but there is a relationship there. Early African preachers who did get to go to college have a focus on the work of the Spirit and individual personal conversion, personal experience. Next slide. That's it. All right, any questions, any comments? Like I say, I look at Hezekiah because Hezekiah says, let's remember where we came from. Let's rebuild the temple. Let's get back there. And when you look at what these people believed and what they wanted to do, of the 13 colonies, 7 of them, even the other they were economic, were expressly designed to witness to the Indians, to the Spanish, to the French, and spent an enormous amount of money building churches, printing Bibles, and sending missionaries out. The Massachusetts Bay Colony sent in its first 100 years, sent 300 missionaries all across the far western United States. They went so far west that they were at the Ohio River. Yes. And it was often that difficult. You think of missionaries going abroad and how much trouble they have raising support. Some of the colonists did it easily. Oglethorpe was rich, and so he just funded it himself. Baltimore, rich. Rhode Island, not so much. That's the way they're presented, but that's not true. Several of the colonies were specifically for religious evangelism, and those ones we talked about, the Massachusetts colony, Rhode Island, Connecticut. New Hampshire splits off from Massachusetts because they want to do a greater work evangelizing the northern tribes. And that's what we're taught. I was digging through my children's, I've got a large collection of children's books that I use when I teach U.S. history, and I was digging through them, and I only found one that really talked about the religious intentions of many of the colonies. Yeah, so it's a story that's been forgotten, since 1963. And that's a problem, because, again, when you dig into these charters, you say, okay, England has a state church, and so you'd expect those phrases, but you don't expect them to the degree. I mean, when you look at the charter of, say, Virginia, the colony of Virginia and its religious stuff, versus, say, North Carolina or Pennsylvania, Virginia has a couple lines, yes, build some churches, do some church stuff, and that's it. The original charter for North Carolina says spend some money on churches, and that's it. When they revised the charter in 1669, they add stuff about you can't be an atheist to be here, the state must support the church, you have to have religious freedom. I mean, when you compare early documents to later documents, yeah, they were taking their religion and their evangelism very seriously. And then when you look at the early history, how many of these colonies sponsored missionaries to go out among the native population, go out to the French, go out to the Spanish. We talk about the great missionary period in American history from 1850 to 1900, but I think you can make a good case that the first real missionary zeal in the United States was from 1630 to 1680. I mean, hundreds and hundreds of missionaries went out, many of them martyred, most of them whose names we don't know anymore. The Quakers martyred by the hundreds as they went out to evangelize. And these are our forefathers, these are our forebears. And you're right, it's a story we just don't know that much about. Anybody else? And you're also right, raising the money to do this stuff is just like a missionary today. Just difficult. Anybody else? Jim, why don't you close us in prayer?